In the story that I proposed to tell, I want to try and tell it in a straightforward and a frank way as possible to help you understand some of the things that have arisen and are transpiring at the present time. I was born in 1933. It was during the Depression. In a farming family, I was the last of eight children in the family. My parents were farmers. We were farming people in the state of Victoria, right down in the southern end of Australia. They were of about 25 years standing Adventists when I was born. That means it'll be going on for 50 years now. My parents have been Adventists. My mother was a Church of England background, the lower Church of England, and quite strict Church of England family. And my father was of Methodist stock, Wesleyan. I guess that the manner in which the Wesleyans of those days used to keep the Sabbath would put most Adventists to shame today. Well, that was the case back there about 50 years ago. It was nearly 50 years ago that my family were brought into the Adventist truth and embraced the message. They became health reformers as soon as they accepted the message. I know that they didn't accept the message in parts or bits. After a number of years, become health reformers as far as in the sense of leaving off things like meat and harmful food, but that became immediate even before they were baptized. Then, just a little of the family background. I can always remember in our home, we weren't a family of saints. I guess we were quite a boisterous family. We were six boys, as the youngest. But, however, we were blessed with the fact that there was always worship in our home. My mother particularly was a good storyteller. There was hardly a story of the Bible that I didn't know by that age of 7 years of age. Never going to bed without that. And there was the case of baths always taken before sundown and any argument settled before the going down of the sun. And the shoes lined up along the wall and the evening sing song when the sun was going down. I don't think there was any of us musical. My mother could play a little bit. And some of us could scarcely keep a chin. But however, it was a joyful noise. When I was about 7 years of age, just the beginning of the war years, one by the name of Steve Nicolisi came to Australia. I think it's a name that most of you have heard of. He was one of the leaders of the German reform movement. He came to Australia at the time when the war question was a very live issue in the Australasian Union. Well, the result was, it was early in the war years that my father and mother and my older sister, who was at that time a young woman, she was in her early 20s, much older than I was 7 years of age, joined the reform movement. Now, thinking back in those years, although I was 7 years of age, I can remember quite a bit. If religion was ever a serious thing before, it certainly was then. I can distinctly remember the reform meant to us homemade bread, a fast once every Sabbath. It wasn't such a good idea to me, but we used to endure it as boys. And study of the scriptures was very earnestly taken up. I can even remember a time when we would go off for a weekend and spend a weekend out in the country. Of course, we lived in the country, but we'd go away sometime, and there we would study the message, the history of the Advent movement that was well known to us even as boys, even as small children. Well, the continued Bible study in the family wasn't long before it produced further results, because it was about after 3 years, coming down to about 1944. I don't remember whether it was 1944 or 1945, that the family, that means my mother, my father and my older sister had left the Reform Movement. When they left the Reform Movement, they managed to take about 40 members out of the movement there in Australia, and they were, you might say, some of the key members of the church, of the Reform Movement. And the result was that it never recovered from the blow as far as the Australasian division is concerned. Since then, it's pretty well died out altogether. Well, that brings us down near the close of the war year. We were isolated members, except for the first 7 years of my life, and I don't remember quite a bit of that. But we never went to a regular church because there wasn't any regular church around. And that was so that when we left the Reform, we continued to be isolated members. We lived down in the country area in Victoria. Then the farm down there, the farm became too straight for us as family was growing up. Some of them were already grown up. Two of them were school teachers, and the two eldest girls left home. But the last four in the family were four boys. And the farm was getting too small for us because two of the boys were growing up and we wanted more land. So we shifted from Victoria, right down in the southern end of Australia. We went 1,000 miles up further north, up into the subtropical area, to the banana area where we commenced banana farming. And still again, that was an isolated area, so we never got to go into a regular church out there either. We were still out right out in the country. But John at that time was, he left school. He was only about 14. He left school quite early. He was the brother who was over here with me. Never had what you call a very much formal education. I continued going on to high school until I finished high school, graduated from high school in 1949. Well, out in the country there, we were way up beneath the McPherson Ranges, right on the border of the New South Wales-Queensland border. And there were a few Adventist families who were isolated with us, who lived out in that region. And so it was our custom to gather together Sabbath by Sabbath, and we had very enjoyable Sabbaths out there in the home, right in the midst of the wilds there in Australia, a very beautiful area. There was no regular preacher there, and as far as preaching is concerned, a lot fell to my father. He was not qualified to be a preacher in the normal sense of the word. However, he wasn't wanting for dint of study and plenty of enthusiasm. And I can remember the boy, he was quite long-winded. You might say I take after him. But we would sometimes shake the time at him when we thought it was time for him to stop. But however, both seemed to enjoy the study, and particularly my sister and my father continued quite vigorous study. I was only a teenager at that time, and I followed it with more than casual interest, although I wasn't a very vigorous participator at that time. I had my high school studies to pursue. Well, the result was that by about 1947 and going on to 1948. As a result of study of the sanctuary question and the truth of righteousness by faith, we discovered that the great work in the heavenly sanctuary, which we know as the final atonement or the blotting out of sins, must transpire before God's people could receive the latter rain. Well, the rain's always been quite a question in our church. Why has it been delayed? What will bring the latter rain to God's people? And here the evidence seemed quite clear to us that the relation between the Day of Atonement and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, that the investigative judgment must come to the believer, his sins must be blotted out before he can participate in the loud cry. Back in those days, it was a doctrine that was, wasn't generally understood, You might say it was quite advanced for those days. Some of us know that the nearest minister wasn't long before he came out to see us. The reason was that when some of these truths began to come into focus, there was quite a lively interest manifested out there in the bush. Whereas there was only just a few studying, people used to gather together from Sabbath to Sabbath. Out there in an isolated area, it wasn't long before it was quite common for 40 or 50 people to go right out in the country and spend the Sabbath out there. And I must admit that when some of these truths became in the focus, and it wasn't so hard to endure a 2-hour sitting of my father preaching. So the nearest minister, who came from the Willembar, came out to see what was going on out there. And this man was supposed to be an authority on the sanctuary question. Well recognised in many parts of the Australasian field. And when he found that there was a group of people who believed that the blotting out of sins was to take place before the close of the grace, before the close of probation and the experience of God's people, this seemed to him to be very, very dangerous teaching, because he believed that the sins of God's people would not be blotted out until they were placed on the scapegoat. And that was after the close of probation. And when he discovered that these people, who were ignorant farmers, did not surrender their understanding of the matter into his hands, he considered that such people should not be tolerated in church fellowship. So the president came up, and I can still remember the meeting with the nearest minister and the president, and so the local minister got up to have his say on the question, and then my sister presented a few points. It wasn't very long before the man was in deep water, and so the president was rather nice about the whole matter. He said, well, I think this wants further study. He said, I admit that I don't know too much about it myself, and he said, I think it would be a good idea if our good pastor here studied into it more too. And we'll see how things develop. Well, we lived on the, right on the Queensland, New South Wales border. That conference president was from North New South Wales. Now, we lived in New South Wales, technically speaking, in the conference. Isolated members. And my sister lived, and her husband, Mrs. Taylor was her name, they lived over in the Queensland conference. So the Queensland conference was interested somewhat in what was going on too. And so they arranged a meeting in 1948 at the Queensland Conference. And most of the workers, there was a handful of workers there. Hooper was the president, Pastor Hooper. And there was a number of workers there. And my sister presented a study on certain features of our faith and pointed out that God's people were to receive the victory over the beast and the image, over the number of his name, by faith, the same as we receive victory over sin. A great work to be accomplished in God's people in the antitypical day of atonement before the work would be go forward under the power of the loud cry. Special attention was drawn to this passage of Scripture, or rather of Spirit of Prophecy here in early writings, 269, where it speaks of the shaking. A group of God's people with a strong faith and agonizing cry. The ministers were particularly interested in this passage. It seemed quite new to most of them that this tremendous experience was to take place before the latter rain would come to the church. The meeting was very cordial, it ended cordially, and the president expressed his appreciation of the study. Then there was one man who stood up, his name was R. A. Greve, who was the minister in the conference. And he said, I've got something to say. He said, I think I see something here in this study that the rest of your ministers don't see. He said, this is new to me. He said, if it's true, it leads to far-reaching conclusions. I want to give it further study. he said, that's true. He says, we're not going to finish the work at the church the way we're going. We're not going to finish it in our present capacity. There's going to be some tremendous changes made before the work is finally finished. This is true. Well, the meeting ended. It wasn't long after that that there was a doctor who had quite a deal of material in his library. He used to make two or three trips to America and he used to bring back different stuff. And it was just a few months after that meeting that we discovered in his library the book by A.T. James called The Consecrated Way to Christian Perfection. I don't know if any of you, I think some of you have read the book. Only a small book. Certainly recommended for any of you to read. A.T. James, of course, was one of the men raised up of God to give the message to our church back in the last century. Well, in reading this book, we were very interested, particularly as the very doctrine that was presented to that conference in 1948 was found in the writings of A.T. James. We never knew at that time. But it was about 6 months after that meeting in the Queensland Conference that we came across The Consecrated Way to Christian Perfection, where the same teaching is brought out there in his book. About the same time, this R.A. Grieve became president of Queensland Conference. He gave some consideration to the study, the question that was brought up. And then, as soon as the man became president, I don't know whether there was any connection, but it was at the same time, he vigorously turned against the teaching on the blotting out of sin. So much so that this man began a restudy of fundamental Adventist position, and in trying to oppose the truth, he took a new position. Now, most Adventists thought at that time, at the close of probation, 1844 down here, this one was blotting out of sins. What to take place here in the latter rain years. Well, Grieve didn't take Grieve long to see that the position that was usually adopted could not be substantiated either from the scriptures or from the writings of Sister White. So he adopted a new position. He says, yes, the blotting out of sins must take place before God's people go forward in the experience of the latter rain. That is clear from Scripture. That cannot be denied. But he said the blotting out of sins doesn't take place here in the most holy place to investigate a judgment. The blotting out of sins takes place at conversion. So sins are blotted out before the latter rain falls upon God's people. So he held that position of the blotting out of sins as taking place at conversion, and so he began a study of Protestant literature, Campbell Morgan and some others, and he moved the truth of the final atonement, took it out of the most holy place, put it back there at the altar. A completed work of atonement on Calvary, not just a completed sacrificial atonement, but a completed work of atonement. And that a believer receives the full atonement the moment he accepts Christ, and therefore at that time his sins would be blotted out. Now when this position was adopted by the Queensland President, as far as we could gather, the whole conference constituency, as far as the workers go, followed him entirely. If there was any dissenting voice, we never heard any. Although this was teaching absolutely contrary to fundamental Adventist position. Then along with that, as Grieve continued to study, and as this teaching on the blotting out of sins in the latter rain was centered around the teaching of perfection, God's people in the last days were to have a special experience, and they were to give the final demonstration to the world of the saving power of Christ in their own lives, he began to do a study of the very basis of the Christian doctrine and of the Christian experience. Reeves was no fool, but he knew that this position of perfection of Christian character was based on the doctrine of the incarnation of Christ, that Christ partook of man's fallen nature and lived a sinless life. And therefore, if man, fallen man, was completely united with Christ's divinity, he would also live a sinless life. And 144,000 would live such a life. Well, when he began to move this doctrine of the final atonement, of the blotting out of sin, from the most holy place of the sanctuary, he also began a study of the nature of Christ, and he adopted the general accepted Protestant position that Christ did not partake of man's fallen nature. And he took the nature of Adam right before Adam fell. And that God's people would still be sinning and repenting right up until Jesus comes in the cloud of heaven. That's what God's people would be doing. While they lived in fallen human nature, they could not expect anything else but be sinning and repenting until Jesus comes in the clouds of heaven. But they were saved by the complete work of atonement, not here, but the complete work of atonement that was made on Calvary with covenant. Well, of course, that was a new position to fundamental Adventists. Well, these 2 points began to be urged by the conference president there in Queensland, and his position was adopted by his workers in that area, and they began preaching it from the pulpits. I can even remember that in 1954 some of this material got into the Australasian Record, which is the official paper of the Australasian Division, where it stated straight out that as soon as a person accepts Jesus, there remains no trace and no record of the man's sin. They're completely blotted out. Gone forever. Well, some of the lay people in the Queensland Conference did not go along with this new teaching. They knew what the Adventist position was, the true Adventist position. They were a very small minority, but they would not accept this position. Now, Reeves was very, very insistent in urging his views. In fact, he was convinced that these teachings that he was propagating would bring a revival to Seventh-day Adventism everywhere. He believed that this was just what was needed to save the church from its legalistic position. And he was all for pushing through this new theology in the church. But there were some lay people who were making some noise. They weren't making a great lot of noise then, but at least it was disturbing to him. And particularly with my sister living in that conference, Greaves found a very handy scapegoat. Because, one, she opposed his position, and two, she had a reformed background. So it was very easy for him, as conference president and the people looking up to him, would say, well, there you are. These people have a reformed background. They're still causing us trouble. Best thing that we can do with them is put them out of the church. And so there was quite an agitation that commenced there in the Queensland Conference, and also got down over the border. We live right on the border, family. Now it was in 1953, 1949, I left high school, just going back a bit. I decided to go farming. I joined my brothers, growing bananas. And then the next farm began to be a bit straight for us, so some remained behind and some went further off. And so I went up 1,000 mile further north, way up in the tropical north of Australia, began cane farming up there in 1953. And it was right in the time that the controversy was raging there in Queensland on the question of these questions on our doctrine. Well, at that time I was about 19 years of age. I wasn't baptised up at that stage. I probably would have been beforehand, only the climate wasn't very conducive to acceptance of the church where I was, and we were isolated members anyway. But we got up there in the tropical north and was 1,000 miles away from the centre of activity, and the local pastor was a very, very nice fellow, and so I took the opportunity and was baptised in the church membership. I think it was 1953. 1954, my sister and husband and a few other members in the Queensland Conference were to fellowship. And it was right on this point, mainly on the teaching of the investigative judgment and so on. R.A. Grieve came to my sister's home at one time and she said to him, "Well, Pastor Grieve, you sit down with me from the Great Controversy. We'll read 3 chapters together and leave it at that." He wouldn't read the Great Controversy. It was evident why the man didn't accept the spirit of prophecy. Although he didn't come out with it and say so to the people at that stage, not at least at that stage. Well, in 1954, the fellowship began, and a few members were to fellowship, not a large number. And Grieve, being very anxious to stamp out any of this heresy, as he called it, that was in danger of upsetting his program of introducing this new theology into the church, not only was content in disfellowshipping certain members from the church, but he even took measures that the church's vote that these people be refused permission even to set foot on any church property. So they were forbidden even to come to church on the Sabbath, allowed even to be seen in the building. I can remember one case where one fellow, it wasn't even a church building, but they were having a regional meeting, and he had friends stopping with him who were Adventists. So they said, "Would you drive us along to this meeting tonight?" Well, he said, "I'm not supposed to go along." He said, "I won't go along," but they said, "Well, bring us." It's only in a general hall, I think it was. So they persuaded him to go along, and he said, "Well, I'll sit out in the car." And they said, "No, come in, sit with us, they won't hurt you. Just come in and sit with us." So he went in. I think he knew more about the atmosphere than they did. Well, the result was that he took the man arms and legs, and they brought him out to the door, and they threw him down the stairs. So, that caused a... Well, actually, what it did, it caused a little bit of interest there among some of the people. Some of them wondered what was going on. Well, at this stage that I was farming up in North Queensland, I was quite a way off activity. And I was living by myself. I lived in a barracks. There was an iron building. And we were pretty busy farming. I was in partnership to work from early morn to late at night. I was a baptized member of the church. I would study the Bible daily. I don't know if I would, perhaps I'd miss sometimes. I always pray, but I had no real experience with the Lord. Looking back then, I'd say that I was an unregenerate church member. And it was about this time that 1954 was about the time when this fellowship was started in the Queensland Conference, that I came face to face with the Lord in a very real way. Probably providential that I used to live by myself in those days. Probably does a man good to live by himself for a time. Probably today we get caught up in the whirl of activity and association so much that a person has no time to think, to be alone with God. I remember much of my spare time, and I didn't have much. I used to do a bit of reading, but it wasn't much reading of spiritual things. Just to look at the letters and so on as a mere form, but wasn't bad literature I used to read, but I used to waste my time reading worthless stuff. And about this time when the Lord spoke to me, called me to follow him in a very real way. That as I looked upon my past life, it seemed so empty and worthless, and I was wasting my time reading a lot of this trash and so on. I was so indignant with it, I got the whole lot, cleaned it out of the room, made a great fire and burnt a lot of it. With a deal of indignation. And before this, we were to discuss the righteousness by faith, imputed righteousness, imparted righteousness. My experience was to pray for the Lord to forgive my sins and go on committing them just to start. I knew it wasn't satisfactory. Realization came that a person lived such a life, although he was a professed believer of Christ, he was still under condemnation. And so in this experience, all I can remember, I took hold by faith. And Christ came to me as a living experience. Not only a theory of righteousness by faith, but take hold of a new life, which was in reality, a divine life. All things have passed away, and behold, all things have become new. The things I once hated, I now love. The things I once loved, I now hate. Well, it was a wonderful experience. It was about sunshine for about a week. I had to drive up and down the paddock on the tractor, tilling the soil and so on. I had a very remarkable experience at that time. I can't explain it. I don't know the nature of it. But at that time, when that experience came to me, and the thoughts began to go through my mind, of all the whole picture of the plan of salvation, the things we used to discuss in our homes from childhood and so on, but even things that I had never understood before began coming to my mind, just rushing through. I couldn't prevent them. They were just there. And I could see myself preaching. I couldn't understand that either. But all these thoughts were going through my mind, things that I never understood before in my life. Well, it lasted about a week. During that time, deciding what was to happen with my life, the Lord gave me conviction to go to college. Never thought of it before, never had any desire to go. Was content with being a farmer and being about that business. But I promised the Lord in the start of the college year, I'd go to college. Well, after a few days of this experience, something else came upon me. The darkness descended. And I can distinctly remember that now there were all sorts of other thoughts going through my mind. Now I felt the power of Satan, the evil angels, I felt it then. And I was involved in a struggle, I don't know how long, whether it was a month or 6 weeks, I forget, I don't know how long. It seemed almost an eternity. But I doubted everything I ever believed. I never doubted the existence of God before, but I doubted everything. But also, I was never given the bad language in my life. Although sometimes some people would work for me. I remember one person came to work for me from time to time on the farm, and he was addicted to foul language. And I suppose hearing it got into my head somehow. But at that time, as the devil came and descended with his darkness, and it seemed as if the Lord forsook me, at least that experience that I had. Every foul thought went through my mind, and I couldn't stop it. Do what I liked, I couldn't stop it. And the devil came along and said, right now you've committed the unpardonable sin. You're just desperately wicked. You might as well give up. I knew if I gave up, or I felt it at that time, if I gave up, that'd be the end. Couldn't explain the nature of the experience. Well, what I did then was get out my Bible and get out the testimonies. And by the light of a carbide light, we had a little gas light. You put carbide in and water on top of it, and you put a match on the top. I don't know if you've ever seen lights like that, but that's the light I had. I used to have them up there in the back. So far into the night, night after night, I began to read. When I come across a precious passage from the Spirit of Prophecy, I'd mark it and I'd linger on it. I'd let the mind take it in. And then I'd take hold and accept that by faith and go on to something else. I went through early writings, I went through desire pages, I went right through great controversy, marking and getting the material out. This was not something that wasn't material to give to anybody else. This was something to save me. I was interested in that present time. I can remember there. I lived alone. I was there in the old cane barracks. And as I take the scriptures and I take the spirit of prophecy, wrestling here with the powers of darkness, I take a passage of scripture. I take a passage of the spirit of prophecy. I could see that I had not a thing to depend upon this world, but the Word of God only, nothing else. And so, as I'd take a scripture sometimes, and hope would come to my heart, well, I'd burst out in song upon the night air, and I guess there was someone around at that time, they would have thought that there was something wrong. That didn't matter, and God and the angels will smile. However, the experience, as far as that struggle, it left. I just look upon it as as I went through it. That's like the time when the clouds come over and you can't see the sun. We lived in an area where they had the greatest rainfall in Australia. In 1950, I think it was, they had 311 inches in 1 year. Gives you an idea how much it can rain up there when it starts. When the rain starts in the wet season of that area, the clouds come down and they hang over the mountain, and you'd never see the sun for day and day after time. You'd almost be tempted after a while to wonder whether the sun existed. But you see, when the clouds went and the sun came out, well, it was more glorious than ever. And so I used to think of that as a type of an experience. Anybody can exercise faith and feel that they're exercising faith, I mean, when they feel that they are partaking largely of the Spirit of the Lord and they're right on the mountaintop and everything is going good. But that's walking by sight. Time to exercise faith is when you can't even see the sun. And the clouds are overhead, but the only thing you depend on is faith. You know that the sun is there, although the clouds are in between. And sooner or later, if you hang on long enough, that sun will shine through again. Just like it used to in that climate up there. When the dust shines through again, it's more glorious than it ever is. So I never forgot that experience. And one thing I learned, that you can't trust in your feelings. You can only trust in the sure word of God, the only thing that we've got to build on upon this world. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. Well, 1955 came, the beginning of the college year. And before going to college, I had opportunity to do a few months' study. And I thought I was busy, but when this experience came, I seemed to have plenty of time to study. I seemed to find it somehow. 1955 came and I went down south. College was nearly 2,000 miles away. On the way south, I called in on my brother John and convinced him that he ought to come to college with me, so he joined me for college in 1955. We got down to college, I think it was about 2 weeks after the college year started. And they accepted us in the college just quickly like that. But we learned when we got there that the faculty had a meeting in the college to decide whether to allow us to stay there or not. Now the reason was because of this president, R.A. Grieve, who lived up in the Queensland Conference, because of his report and so on, considered us that it'd be dangerous down there in college, so they had a meeting. And some said, well, we better put these boys out of college before there's any trouble. Although I'd never had anything to do with any church affairs at all up to that stage. Never been involved in a thing, neither my brother nor myself. But there was at least two men there, we heard, that said, no, wait till the trouble comes. So we stayed in the car. I can remember that there was a distinct aloofness amongst some of the ministerial students in the college, so much amongst the ordinary run of students in the college, but amongst some of the ministerial students. They were going for the ministry, and I suppose that they should keep in good company. That's what the attitude. Well, it wasn't very long before Bible classes started, and we got into friendly discussion with the teacher in the Bible class, and curiosity got the better of the two of the ministerial students after he'd been there about 2 or 3 weeks. And so one of them came around, and then 2 of them came around, and they said, "Well, we want to study with you. We want you to give us a study. We want you to tell us what you got. Would you give us a study?" And so we said, "Sure, we'll give you a study." And so they said, "All right then, well, see what our plan is. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. We'll have a study." I think it was 5 o'clock, it might have been 4 o'clock. It was very early in the morning while the college was still wrapped in slumber. They said, "We'll start at that time." So they said, "I'll tell you where we'll meet you. We got up in the morning, that's right," and the two boys were ready to hear the study, the books under their arm, and papers and pencils. And they said, "Well, we'll go over to the music studio." And although the college was still wrapped in slumber, they said, "We'll go around this way, and you'll go around that way, and we'll meet you over there." So we went over, and in the college studio there was a big blackboard on the board, very nice. And I took a piece of chalk and gave the boys a study on righteousness by faith. Just a very simple study on 3 points, I can still remember it. Imputed righteousness, imparted righteousness, and everlasting righteousness. Well, on the first 2 points, imputed righteousness and imparted righteousness, justification and sanctification, I could speak in a measure, fresh from my own experience. And touching the third point, everlasting righteousness, the final work in the most holy place, where the final work would be done in the final atonement for God's people, and they would be secured evermore from the devices of Satan. They would be cleansed and clothed with the armor of Christ's righteousness for eternity. I could at least speak from the conviction which I had that the judgment of the living was very, very soon upon us, and this work had to be done, very short. And as the boys listened, they listened spellbound. They expressed that they'd never heard of anything like it before. And before, their study was a study of theology, but this was not just theology, this was something real to them. And they couldn't keep it to themselves, and so they began to talk to some of the other ministerial boys about the place. And it was very soon that the room where John and I were situated became as busy as a doctor's surgery. Boys coming in and out all day long, and night too. And conviction began to take hold of them that the judgment of the living was right upon us. There was an urgent work of preparation. I can remember some of the boys, when lights were out, they would take their torch and they'd begin reading some of the solemn passages of the Spirit of Prophecy. There were some requesting prayer and confessing their sins and getting ready. And so there was quite a stir in the boys' hall. Well, there were some, their prejudice was so grave, of course, that their alarm was proved. And I can remember that in the prayer bands of the college, when the boys used to break up for the prayer band, there were some of the prayer bands who were praying that the conviction of the judgment would take hold of all the boys, and the others were praying that the Lord would stamp out this terrible heresy, taking hold of some of the gentlemen. So there was quite a few interested, and it looked as if there was going to be quite a revival in the place. Well, it wasn't long before it died out. A few stories started getting around. I have a good idea who started them, but that doesn't matter. That this is just Shepherd Wright, look out, you'll get caught. And some of the ministerial students who quickly embraced this, they began to leave it just as quickly because they thought, well, they'll get themselves in the hot water. And this was no good. And the result was that there was, where it was manifested a large interest, there was a meeting held in one of the minister's homes, one of the Bible teachers, and we had a discussion down there. He invited us down to the home, and and there was a number of them there. And I can remember that when the shaking, as it were, came amongst them, that there was, for the time being, one student left out of many who manifested an interest in the subject. There was one left. And some of the men who were very keen, well, when they'd see you walking along the campus, they'd say good day to you very quickly if they did say good to that and keep going. But, however, some of them, after a while again, began taking up interest more quietly this time, and instead of rushing in and taking hold of it, you know, they began to study it more quietly and to investigate the some of these subjects. But there was quite an interest manifested with a few of the students where the spirit of prophecy was a very dead thing in the college. You couldn't help but notice that the spirit of prophecy wasn't studied really in the classes. You go right through the college, you know, you need notes in the spirit of prophecy book. And I suppose it may be the same today. But at that time, the spirit of prophecy, the testimonies used to be pulled down from the shelves and the different students used to read them. Well, after that, things settled down somewhat, and John and I settled down to a very earnest study that year. We had a lot to study, and we felt we had a lot of ground to make up. We did most of our own study by ourselves. We went to classes, we took about four subjects each, but we went along to the classes, I suppose, more or less as a break from our own study program that year. That year, the college assistant librarian came, he was interested in the message, and he came along and produced. He said, we have here in the library the studies of Wagner and Jones. And he pulled them out of the library, and we dusted the covers off them. They hadn't been read for years. And we were interested in the message of 1888. We knew there was quite a deal in the spirit of prophecy about the light that came to the church in 1888. And we got these studies out of Wagner and Jones. There was quite a pile of them all together. And we began studying the message that was brought to the church back there approximately 70 years ago. Well, I can never forget myself the wonderful revelation of truth that came in the study of Wagner and Jones' material. We took their writings almost line by line, read it and searched it, compared it with the spirit of prophecy. And I shall never forget as vast vistas of truth began to open to my mind as I read their studies on righteousness by faith. With evidence that here was a conception of the everlasting gospel of justification by faith far more deep, far more beautiful than it was ever presented in the church. It wasn't commonly taught. It was quite evident that here was something that was... You could read it, although it was written years ago, you could read the Spirit of God in the writings there. And somehow, the writings of Wagner and Jones, I learned things from the writings of Wagner and Jones that I had not learned from the study of the Spirit of Christ. Some things that seemed to bring out more powerfully and more forcefully than Spirit of Prophecy did. Although afterwards, when we went back to the testimony, there were the same truths there. But particularly Jones, in some of his sermons, Jones seemed to be a very rugged character, and he'd speak in a very forceful, dynamic and rugged way. You could tell by his, by reading his writings. And the light, righteousness by faith was very, very precious, very, very clear. This message we compared with the great sanctuary truth. The grave controversy was still on. The issue on the atonement and on the nature of Christ, it hadn't spread right out the Australasian division. Well, we came to the end of 1955, college year ended. 1956 came around, and my brother didn't return to college with me, and I returned to college alone. And the 1956 year, I think I only took three studies that year. I wanted to pursue my own studies mainly in the college. I took three subjects. And the climate began to change somewhat. 1956, one of the Bible teachers, the head Bible teacher of the college, got me to teach some of the Bible classes in the college. It was mainly Daniel and Revelation there. He used to have a clash in subjects, one period out of three, and so I used to teach the Daniel and Revelation class once a week. just an illustration to illustrate the same atmosphere of suspicion wasn't so strong. In fact, I used to get along quite well with the head Bible teacher. We became quite close friends. And I remember when we went to college, first year there with this Bible teacher, we began studying Romans and Galatians. I remember when we were studying the book of Galatians, he said this law here was a ceremonial law. He was presenting it as merely a ceremonial law. So I began throwing in a few thoughts at what especially the moral law, the Apostle Paul was speaking about. So we used to get into discussion in class. I'd take ceremony and make it moral law, and he'd say it was a ceremonial law. Well, I remember some of the students came to me and they said, "Now listen, we want to give you a tip. If you want to get A's from this person, from this teacher, don't you contradict what he said in class." Well, personally, I never found that was so. I found him quite liberal. And before the Book of Galatians finished, he was teaching both ceremonial and moral law in it. And there were quite a few other things like incidents like that arose. Well, 1956 was an interesting year. There was some significant developments. One significant development in 1956 was that R.A. Grieve was transferred from the Queensland Conference over to the New Zealand Conference. That's just over the sea, about 1,500 miles. And when we heard that he was going over to the Queensland Conference, we knew, we were close friends with some of the New Zealanders in the college who were interested in the message of righteousness by faith and these subjects. And we supplied them with quite a deal of material on Wagner Jones and information on the sanctuary and the blotting out of sins. And they went back to New Zealand at the end of the college year, 1955-56, college year ends there at the end of the year. And it happened that they beat R.A. Grieve over to New Zealand and began getting this material around the New Zealand conference amongst the lay people mainly, and making a preparation for R.A. Grieve to come over there. So he got over there, and there was more agitation in New Zealand than there was in Queensland, because more people were ready for Grieve when he got there. The same pattern followed in New Zealand. The ministry, on the whole, for the most part, all that could be discerned, followed Grieve and began teaching his theology. But the lay people who were ready, they objected. And so he began to be more dogmatic on his point on the final atonement, on the complete work of atonement here, and the work on his theory of the nature of Christ. He began to stress that more strenuously in the New Zealand conference. In fact, his views began to be more and more radical. Interesting enough, that very year, I saw a copy, photostat copy, of correspondence that had passed between a leading man in Washington and R.A. Grieve, where it was as plain as anything that one of the figures from Washington was in he was in sympathy with Grieve's position. What he virtually said to Grieve, "You are right, I grieve." But he cautioned to go, "Let's go along together, let's go steady. Don't rush things." A little while later, the manuscript, Questions on Doctrine, came out. We heard about the wonderful advent of the great men of the world. Some great men of the world, it was told over there in Australia, were beginning to sit up and take notice of Adventists. And so everybody was to get ready for the loud cry, because now the great men of the world were going to recognize us as Christians and so on. And so I heard about this book going out, and 250 copies of the original manuscript before the book came out. Wasn't the original one, but it was leased to us, the second attempt at writing it. 250 manuscripts were sent around the world to leading men in the world, and one of the men who got it was the head Bible teacher of the Australasian Mission Society. And I don't know whether he ever read it, but he gave the manuscript to me to read. I was very interested in reading. So I read the manuscript. I knew who wrote the manuscript. I knew who was responsible for the writing of the book, Questions on Doctrine. And there in the book were some of the same positions, the two same positions that Greaves took. Admittedly, some of the points were not, particularly on the atonement, were not as radically expressed as Greaves expressed, but nevertheless, the same bent within the book, Questions on Doctrine. And not only that, I knew that one of the authors of Questions on Doctrine was the man who was writing to Greaves, who had seen his correspondence, who was sympathizing with Greaves in his position. So I read the book. I can remember when the Bible teacher asked me what I thought of it after I read it. I said, well, much of it was good. Some good material in the book. Certainly like a copy of it myself when I came out, but I had to shake my head when on some of these themes like the atonement and the nature of Christ, particularly I mentioned to him the nature of Christ, I said, well, my position has been that this teaching is anti-Christ. The old Adventists, our pioneers, taught, and I mentioned some of the Adventist writers, believed that this position was anti-Christ, and they wrote straight out that it was anti-Christ, and I can't help agreeing with these men, that position is very, very unfortunate that has ever come in. Well, returning to the R.A. Greaves issue, apparently he didn't take the advice he received altogether from overseas here in America, because they advised him to go steady, not to push his views too quickly or too radically, because he might get into difficulty. Well, Greaves lengthened the final atonement. He took the work of the blotting out of sins out of the most holy place. He said that doesn't take place here, it takes place here, in the experience of a Christian. Next point he went there, he said, if there's no record in the heavenly sanctuary, therefore he that believeth in me shall not come into judgment. As the Revised Version says in the translation of John 5. He that believeth in me shall not come into condemnation, some translations give. He that believeth in me shall not come into judgment. You see, if there's no record kept of the believer, what's the use of judging him? So there's no record for the Christian. No record for the, no judgment for the believer in Christ. And he took that position. And it wasn't long before the judgment was out, so the 2,300 days were out. And he was called up to, there was so much noise made in the New Zealand division. It wasn't by the ministry, it was by the lady that they thought the division leaders thought they better do something about it. And so Greaves was brought over and called to answer for some of his position. It was quite a strange turn of events, because he was called to answer on two points of his faith. One was on this work of the judgment, the final atonement, as he was doing away with fundamental Adventism. The second was the nature of Christ. At that time, the Australasian division couldn't go along with either position. But, at the very time when Greaves was there, with the leaders of the Australasian division answering for his faith, the new position came out from Washington on the nature of Christ. And so they let him go on the nature of Christ, and they only dealt with him on the atonement. I can remember in college when the Bible teachers used to teach one thing on the nature of Christ, and as suddenly as that, when news came out from certain ones of Washington, that this was new to be the new line of our theology, the position was changed as quick as that. Men who were once as adamant that the teaching that Jesus never took our fallen nature was the anti-Christian teaching, that was the doctrine of Antichrist, was just as strenuously teaching the other view. It wasn't long before the issue arose in 1959, where they advised some certain students that ministerial students, if they wished to abide by the old view of the nature of Christ, that they weren't acceptable for ministerial students in the college. Well, the result wasn't a very good issue that they, because he wouldn't surrender his position on the judgment in the 2,300 days, they relieved him, let him out of his position to think it over for a while. Now, within a matter of about 2 weeks, the man had given up the Sabbath and the law of God and everything. So you see the ground that he went. It's very logical when you take it. First of all, he said no record of sin for the believer. Sins are blotted out at conversion. Second point, if there's no record, there's no judgment. And the third point, if there's no judgment, there's no law. I don't know whether you've got the other two steps. Because if there's no law, there's no sin, and if there's no sin, you don't need saints. But I met the man after he left the church completely and joined up with the Sunday keeping. I think he's joined up with he was preaching for a while with the Church of Christ and writing tracts against Adventism, and he mentioned the two things that he left the Adventist Church on. He said, I left the Adventist Church, he wrote an article called In Chains of Adventism. He left the church on the atonement, on the nature of Christ. That's why there's Adventism, he said. And he said, the reason how I found the truth, he said, I came in contact with a small group of people in Queensland. And he said they were teaching certain things, and he said, I began restudying the whole position of Adventist theology, and I found the lies, and so I left the church. And he claimed, interesting enough, he said, since I've left the church, he said, now he said, the Adventist church are coming over with me on these two positions, which I left the church on. I met him in the Brisbane market. Met Grieve up there, and I said to him, well, if you're out of the church now, you don't believe in Mrs. White. He said, tell me, I said, according to the teachings of Mrs. White, who was right in the controversy in Queensland? I said, was the ministry right? Were you right? Was the conference right? I said, well, were those lay people right? You know the writings of Mrs. White. He said, well, he said, there was no question, he said. He said, they were right. He said, that's why where I stand where I am today, he said. He said, I began restudying the whole position. So he said, I found the truth. And he held it to that time. He also showed me in his home copies of correspondence that he had received from a certain figure in Washington. And that one of the men was responsible for the writing of the book, Questions and Doctrine. And without a shadow of doubt, he had received quite a deal of encouragement in his theological positions from this certain individual. Well, 1956 ended college. I left college just before the end of the college year, went to help my other brother down in Victoria to do some work. I wasn't sure of my future, whether I'd go for the ministry or not. Things didn't seem too conducive, and so I thought that I'd wait. So I returned to the farm in 1957. Went back sugar farming, went back in the farm for a while, and thought I'd wait up there for some time. And while I was there, I began writing a few notes from the book of Daniel, which I began writing, and I was the material I had available. And then near the end of 1957, I went down south to the college area again, and several reasons. One was that I wanted to finish writing the research on Daniel, which later I called Vision by the Edicle. I think some of you have heard that name. And the other reason was I wanted to get myself a wife. I was writing at that time to Miss Valerie Mann, some of you know. And I returned back to college at the end of 1957, and I found the atmosphere there quite good, quite well received. In fact, I was thinking of completing the ministerial course, and when I put down my name for the next college year, they held an election at the end of every year to vote the next member of the president of the ministerial league of the college students, ministerial students in. And I was surprised when the student body voted me in as president of the ministerial league. In 1958, I returned to college, and that was a fairly heavy year in my studies. I think I had about 10 subjects to do in 1 year, which was about a double day, because I had 3 subjects from 1956 to pick up, and I was doing two studies by correspondence, and also the full normal full course. While I've lost interest in the manuscript I'd written, Vision by the Hidical, it was only in a rough form, so some friends up north wanted to publish it. Not publish it, they wanted to copy it. put it out in Romeo form, mimeograph. So they mimeographed it, and I was a bit hesitant about it because things were sailing along pretty good at college by this stage, and the climate seemed to be quite good, and it looked as though I was going to settle right down, to sail right through, finish the ministerial course, and do the course, and the Lord was going to open up the way for me to enter into the ministry after all. So that was 1958, and the college year ended pretty quietly. I might say just one thing I've neglected to mention. During the college, the years at college, it was customary for me to meet with different students, either in prayer bands or discuss the Bible with them. And we had a big chart made, which was about 16 feet long by 8 feet deep, on the prophecies of Daniel Revelation, which took up one side almost of the wall in my room at college. And so the students used to come in, and we used to gather around this big prophetic chart with all the beasts and trumpets and seals and churches all on the one chart, synchronizing it together. And we had quite a number of studies at the foot of that chart, and we used to study the message of righteousness by faith and so on there at the college. That was 55, 56, and also in the year 58. I might say that all during this time, the understanding of the message of righteousness by faith and the great sanctuary of truth began developing in my mind, as well as in the mind of some others. As early as 1956, I was able to set down the basic positions on the same message as I'm preaching at the present time. Only, of course, it's developed more fully in my mind. And I didn't know whether I could present it or not, or whether the time had come to present it. Some of the things then seemed quite revolutionary, I guess. I remember trying an experiment at college in 1956, and we used to have a Bible class every Sabbath morning where about 20 students gathered together, and I tried presenting an outline on the sanctuary, on the important points, showing that the work in the most holy place, the cleansing of the sanctuary, was an experience. Wasn't just something that took place in heaven, but it was an experience in the lives of God's people. We were to enter into it by faith, we were to cooperate with Christ, and for the great experience of the cleansing of the sanctuary, and then we follow the ladder on. Well, I don't think the message got through. I don't know why. I suppose it was because the time had not come to those things to be generally received. I don't know, but probably accounts for the fact, while I returned to the farm in 1957, I thought I'd wait a while, see what would happen. Well, 1958 came and ended. Seemed to be quite... the year went off smoothly, and I can remember that I made some remark to my brother in a letter, my brother Lawrence, up in North Queensland, how things were going quite well down there at college. I'm no longer regarded as a heretic anymore. I'm quite proud of the fact. I teach Bible classes in the college. I take some of the chapel exercises, and I'm president of the ministerial league, so the president don't worry anything about it. So things are really fine down here now. And my brother wrote back and said one remark. He says, "Woe unto you, and all men shall speak well of you." So the college year ended, 1958. A couple of significant things happened in 58. Was this, that for the first time we got the manuscript by Whelan and Short. It came to Australia, 1958. We read that. And then, also we began hearing a little of Andreessen's agitation there. Some of his letters got to Australia, and the manuscript of Whelan and Short also came to our attention in 1958, and we saw the first evidence from anybody overseas what we were interested in Whelan and Short's manuscript was, not because of all their detail in 1888. That wasn't the thing that struck our attention in Whelan and Short, because we were already aware of the issue of 1888, but because here were two men who perceived that the cleansing of the sanctuary was an experience for the remnant church. And the 1888 message was not just Luther's message, it was not just Wesley's message, but it was the great message of righteousness by faith, in the very words of Whelan and Short, parallel and consistent with the great work of cleansing the sanctuary. And here were two men in 1950. They were writing on the very thing that we were interested in at that time. Well, college year passed, and I thought, well, I'm coming back for my last year of college. Graduate next year. I had a few subjects to polish off, a few secular subjects. I finished all the Bible, and I already had my grades. So I just had to do a few subjects in the last year. And this manuscript written by the Hittigall, there was a few copies in circulation, not many, and I wasn't too anxious in giving to anybody, but the friends up north had a few copies of it. And I can remember that as I was leaving college to go canvassing, during the vacation, before the next year came up, I handed it in to one of the head Bible teachers and I said, what do you think I ought to do with this manuscript written by the Hittigall? I was quite willing to withdraw or anything. I wasn't anxious to make an issue over it. I thought someone might take exception to some of the views there on the King of the North. So I went canvassing during that vacation. And two significant things happened between 1958 here and 1959. Well, this one was, I got notice that not to come back to college, that my acceptance was rescinded. One of the reasons given was the manuscript vision by the Hittigall, but that's not the reason given now, and I can see that wasn't the real true reason, because I handed the vision by the Hittigall in, and I'd asked the brethren's advice what I ought to do with it anyway. And they said that they thought there was some seeds of the very words used. They didn't say there was criticism in it, they said there was seeds of criticism in it. And so I got the news that I was canvassing at the present time, at that time. I got the news that they didn't want me back at college for the last year. I had somehow guessed what it was. It wasn't the college, it was some of the leading brethren in the administration. Reports got back to them from time to time of my influence in the college with some of the ministerial students of the study groups that we used to have there. Although everything used to go off quietly, but some of them were getting out into the field with some of these ideas on the sanctuary and righteousness by faith, and they thought that this was upsetting the students. And also, there was an agitation beginning in questions on doctrine. I wasn't promoting any agitation on it, although I was opposed to its positions on a couple of major points. And there was an agitation beginning in America, and Andreessen's letters were starting to get around the Australian field, and I think that they didn't want any upset happening in the college for the 1959 year. And also I think that the brethren didn't want to avoid the embarrassment of knowing what to do with me when I finished the course. So I got the news. I wasn't greatly shocked. It came as a surprise because I could have understood if they put me out of 1956, I could have understood almost if they put me out of 1955 with the great a grief issue going, but everything went so smoothly in 1959 or 58. The brethren only knew it, I was getting pretty near to eating out of their hand, as it were. But everything seemed to be ready to sail just clean through. So I remember at that time I was canvassing, and I didn't canvass for a couple of days. I went down and sat down on the beach and thought about it for a while. And after a while I went there. I remember one day I went, slept the whole day out in the sun on the sand on the beach down there in Tasmania, right down in the bottom of Australia. And I slept the whole day in the sun and I got up after a good sleep and I was right. So another significant thing happened, of course, I should mention, during application. I took unto myself a wife. Now you might ask, well, what was her attitude to this new development? Perhaps one comment is sufficient. When she left for college and Valerie went to college, her father had expressed one wish to her. He said, well, whatever you do, don't marry a conference yes man. And all that I can say is that as he probably realizes now, that his prayer and his wish was answered far more abundantly than he asked or thought. Well, decision had to be made what to do, whether it was to return to the farm or whether I'd return to, I wasn't allowed to go to college. Well, we had arranged for our home, for a place of accommodation in the village, just near the college there, in the village in that area. And so I was impressed to stay on there at college. They put me up until the Lord directed me to go elsewhere. The home was arranged and the place, and I'd set myself there for settle down for that year for study. So I'd stay there at college, and in that area, and also that we could still contact a few students who were interested in that. We lived around that area, so we went back and lived just near the college. Now, I was interested to know, get to the bottom of why I wasn't allowed back to college. I had a good idea, but I thought I'd find out. So I went along to college, and I'd meet one of the leading teachers, and I'd ask him what was the score. And he'd say, well, I don't know. Didn't know anything about it. And I'd go along to another leading man and say, well, what's going on here? This is an institution of learning. I said, how can you, I mean, even if you do disagree with a man. I said, how can you put a person out of college for this? Well, must admit, some of them very bashful, very embarrassed about the whole situation. But all that I could get, all the sense that I could get from them, was to go and see Pastor Clifford. He was the president of the Australasian Division. So I very soon learned that there was one man, at least one man in particular, and probably two or three, but particularly one man who had a vast amount of influence in the Australasian Division. He seemed to almost have a tremendous influence in every college, in every conference, a tremendous influence in the college. And so it seemed that I soon learned that it wasn't really the college who was responsible for my for my readmittance there, but it was the Australasian Division. I went along to the office. I had a couple of meetings with Pastor Clifford. He viewed my activities with great alarm, to say the least. So I had a talk with him for quite a while. We never really got on to discuss any doctrine, except that we discussed a few points in the vision by the Hegel. And so I got home and thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, I could see the issue developing on the sanctuary on righteousness by faith. It seemed to me that the light was so clear that sooner or later it would go forward, it would awaken God's people in the church, eventually it would go forth to lighten the whole earth with the glory of God. And so not wishing to create an issue over any minor matter on Daniel 11, on who was the King of the North and what would the King of the North do, and realizing that in 1888 a controversy came in on the law of Galatians before the message came, stirred up bitterness and agitation among some of the brethren, I wrote to the Australasian Division president and said, all right, then I'll withdraw the manuscript, vision by the Edicts. There's only a handful of them got out, but I was letting him know that it was going to be cooperative anyway, as far as possible, and that I wasn't interested in that. I went to see him again and mentioned to him that there was something that a number of us was interested in. It was on the great message of the sanctuary, the reality and the meaning of the open door, and the work of the final atonement in the most holy place of the sanctuary. One thing became very evident right from the outset. The brethren seemed to give me the impression, at least I may be wrong, although I don't think so. They weren't interested in any hearing anyway. And it was, the suggestion was more or less brushed aside. But I settled down in 1959 to write the book, God's Eternal Purpose. To write out the gospel of Jesus Christ in the light of the sanctuary service. And I might mention one experience I had writing this book. The idea came into my mind in 1958. I wrote an outline of God's Eternal Purpose when I was at college. I had no prospect of ever finishing it because I never had time to finish it. But I got the time in 1949 because 1959 I had time to write it because I was let out of college. So devoted some time to the writing of this book. I remember as I was approaching the final chapters and the outline was in my mind and thoughts were coming to my mind, I went outside and stood upon a nail. I went outside to chop some wood for the house. My foot came up pretty big. I went down and got a couple of tetanus injections and tried to continue on writing while the thoughts were coming to my mind. I wanted to finish it with one foot in hot water and one foot in hot and cold water to try and ease the pain. But then the Asian flu came to Australia. It was in Australia at the present time, and I was taken with a very severe epidemic. There was a number who lost their lives in Australia with it. And I went down with a temperature of about 106. And the temperature started on Sunday. Fever started on Sunday and went through night after night through that week. And Valerie was up night after night trying to fight it, bring the temperature down. And I was semi-delirious at night time, half stupid, with the fever. It got a bit weak during the week and I was getting weaker and weaker. And we got near the end of the week, and I was getting pretty weak, and Belle was tired, and she went over to see one of the boys at college, one of our friends, and said to him, well, would you, I sent a note over to him and said, would you come over tonight and look after me, because Belle is so tired she can't stop up, and I want someone to look after me tonight and get this temperature down if it comes up again. Because I was feeling that if I went on another one or two nights, I'd be just about finished with such a high temperature. So, it was Friday evening when Valerie went off to get this student, to get permission for him to come across, and he'd come across. And the sun was going down on Friday afternoon, and during the yard, all this was in my mind. The sun was going down, and the Sabbath was coming on, and I began meditating on the scriptures. And just lying there in my bed. I don't know why I chose on Hebrews. I didn't have my Bible, but my mind turned to Hebrews chapter 1. And as I lay there in my bed, just meditating, at that time I was so weak with the flu, I couldn't speak. Just only in a whisper. I couldn't walk. Barely stand on my feet. But I lay on my back and I began playing in Hebrews 1 off my heart. Started in Hebrews 1 and I was meditating down on the scripture. Of God in sundry times and of God with man has spoken to the fathers by the prophets, hath in these dark days spoken unto by his son. Reflection of Jesus Christ, the express image of his person, and then thou, O God, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. Thou, Lord, in the beginning, hast laid the foundation of the earth. And my mind was going down, contemplating on Christ, the great creator, the sustainer and the creator of heaven and earth. Here was the contemplation of Christ, the majesty of heaven, Hebrews 1. And getting down near to the end of Hebrews 1, I can remember I began to say the scripture aloud instead of saying it to myself. And as I began saying it aloud, I felt my voice get a bit of power, and I know it was in the house. I began to repeat the scripture off by heart. And when I came into Hebrews 2, the more so, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death. And the reality of that scripture, in a way that I cannot explain, but I can only remember the experience, the reality of that scripture came to me as never before. Here was a scripture that I knew off by heart. I'd read it many a time, but somehow the reality of it, the tremendous reality, came to me. Jesus in Hebrews 1, the Creator, the great eternal God. And then we see Jesus in Hebrews 2. Not just where man was before man was created, but running underneath a man to succor him, to hold him up, to stop him from falling. Down here in man's place, the gift of Christ to the sons of men. And I began repeating Hebrews 2 over. Well, I could only say this, that the Lord drew very nigh in a very remarkable manner. In a way that I cannot explain. I could not finish repeating Hebrews 2. I could not repeat saying it off by heart. It was too much for me. The only thing I could do, that the reality of God's presence and the gift of Himself for me was so tremendous that I could just weep and also weep for joy. It came in a consciousness at that time, I can remember with distinctness, that it is a thing to know that Christ died for my sins, but somehow experience and sometimes transcend knowledge. But a recognition of the fact that Christ was crucified for me, and the gift of the eternal God, this person whom I saw in Hebrews 1, was given for me, and given to me personally, and that he came for the sufferings of death to me. That came home to me with tremendous reality. And as I began thinking about it, just lying down in my bed, and in the meantime, Valerie and Milton had came inside the house, and they were in the kitchen. And I was thinking about this and meditating upon this, and And as I was so doing, somehow the Lord revealed to me, just like that, the thought came into my mind, the Lord will do heal you. He'll rebuke that fever. And it seemed such a small thing, just easy thing for the Lord to do. It so blessed my soul that just to rebuke that fever, that was just a smaller thing for the Lord to do. And so I took hold by faith, just like that. And like the thrill of an electric shock, went up my spine and I jumped out of bed. And Milton and Valerie came in to see what was going on. And I was here. So we had a season of prayer, of thanksgiving, and we sang some hymns. I was still weak. I got back into bed, took it easy. I thought that was wise. And I took a few days to get my strength back, but the fever had completely gone, just like that. Well, the book was finished, the manuscript, God's Eternal Purpose, after I got out of bed, and then I finished the book. And I was thankful to God I was able to finish the book in the light of the revelation that the Lord had given me. And I mentioned it to the leaders of the Isolation Division. I had a book, and I didn't think they were interested in it anyhow. Maybe I had the wrong attitude, but somehow I mentioned it to them. Well, their attitude was, well, yes, we have a New Life Committee. If you accept our decision, if you give us commitment that you'll abide by our decision and give us that commitment, then we'll read the manuscript. So I thought it'd be a good idea if they read the manuscript first and I'd see what their opinion of it was before I decide whether I'd accept their decision or not. Well, that was their attitude. You abide by our decision. You give us commitment that you'll accept our finding. Then we'll examine the manuscript after you give that commitment. So I said, no thanks, I can't do it. I'm a Protestant. If you choose 100 men, if you pick 100 responsible brethren around the field, and we'll choose 50 each and send it around for them to examine, and if some see light in it, well, if none of them see light in it, I'll drop it. If some see light in it, send it overseas and let them examine it over there. The brethren said, well, we can't bypass our standard committee. This is our procedure. We cannot alter it for any one man. And so I left the manuscript just for a while on the side. Decision comes again what to do. I've seen that studied long enough, and I didn't know we couldn't just keep on studying and studying. And we thought that perhaps we might go back farming. We had a farm up north, and we'd have been quite happy to go back there, and we'd almost made the decision to go back farming again. And we got an invitation to go down to Victoria and to visit a young minister down there and some of his friends just before we went up north. And so we went down to Victoria, and when the news got around that we were around there, there was a very significant meeting at Benalla. I think some of you read about it in the Church Triumphant. Number of people gathered together, most of them workers, about 21 workers all together. One minister, one ordained minister, one worker, a couple of workers and some canvassers and some school teachers gathered together in this young minister's home on Sabbath afternoon and Saturday night, and they'd asked me to present the sanctuary message, the lay all the cards on the table as it were, and I was able to speak to them for 4 hours. 2 hours I spoke, we had an hour's break, and also I spoke for another 2 hours. Well, looking back, I think that was probably one of the most, if not the most remarkable meeting I'd ever been in my life. And those who were there testified to the same. I cannot remember much what I said at that time, except that the whole significance of the sanctuary was outlined over that period of 4 hours. Folks there sat through it as if just passed in a few minutes, and with one accord, everyone in the room testified to the very marked presence of the Holy Spirit there at that meeting. So much so that it seemed that the Spirit of God, in a remarkable manner, had set his seal to the preaching of the sanctuary, the truth, and the call to the marriage in a very remarkable way. The result was that within a few days, invitations had come in from various parts of Victoria to speak to various groups in Victoria. Within 4 or 5 days, the brethren up at the Australasian Division had heard about this Bible study in the home of this young minister. He was promptly dismissed from the work, and the few others who attended were threatened. Well, the message spread very rapidly all over Victoria in a matter of days, and then After that, we went back north up to Brisbane again, and the message began spreading over Australia and over the New Zealand field. Well, when we went up to Brisbane, there was very strenuous opposition up there to the message, the same as it was in various parts of Victoria. I remember one school teacher was dismissed from Victoria from the work, a young school teacher, and the reason for his dismissal was very remarkable. What happened was this. There was a young man in Brisbane who was a social worker, quite prominent in the church, quite well thought of, and he got sick. It wasn't long after I had this experience myself. And he was in hospital, very desperately ill. He had had two operations on peritonitis, and an abscess developed in his stomach, somewhere here or down in his bowel, rather. And he was just weak and emaciated in hospital with this abscess, and he was going under the third operation. His case was very critical. And so I never met him before. And so this school teacher said to me, come up and see Tom. He's in hospital. He says he's a very, very nice fellow. And he says he's desperately ill. He said he could just go like that. So let's come up and visit him. So he took me up to the hospital to visit Tom. And he looked a very, very poor sight indeed there in bed. And we discussed, talked with him and prayed with him. And then the next day I went back and I had a very brief Bible study with him just on the Christ and his great work in the sanctuary, the simplicity of the gospel as it's seen in the light of the sanctuary. Tom enjoyed the study very much. Sabbath came, that was Friday. The next day was Sabbath and Tom was to go under his operation in the afternoon, Sabbath afternoon. So the school teacher friend of mine and I, we went up to have special prayer with Tom. And I remember sitting on his bedside and I talked to him that he was seriously ill. He ought to face the fact, and we discussed it over, to live as Christ and to die as gain. And Tom had dedicated his life to Christ, and we discussed his hope of salvation in the Lord Jesus Christ. And his hope was in Christ, nothing less. And so we discussed it. Well, if anything happened to him, to die is gain. There's nothing to worry about. Death is just a moment of sleep. But there's a work to do for Christ, and we would commit his case into the hand of the Lord. While we prayed there very earnestly for Tom, and somehow the conviction came to us that it was the will of the Lord to heal him, and we prayed there very earnestly for him, and we left him in good spirits, but very, very ill. Well, his operation was to be on the Sabbath afternoon, and we went round on Sabbath night to see how Tom had recovered and see how he was recovering from his operation. So we went up into the room, into the bed where Tom was, and there was Tom sitting up in the bed. And we thought, well, that was a quick way to recover from an operation such as that. So he said, what happened? Tom was sitting there with a very different look in his face, much of his colour returned, and he was sitting up in bed as large as life, and we said, well, what happened? He said, they come, and he said, they examined me, he said, the abscess wasn't there, he just gone. A little while Tom was out of bed, and he got to studying the great message of the sanctuary. He accepted it. The conference was so annoyed there in the Queensland area that they called the school teacher in and they said, well, why did you take Brinsmead up and introduce him to Tom Tugler? And, well, he said, the boy was sick, he said. He was dying desperate in the hospital. He said, we went up and prayed for him. He said, what's wrong with that? He said, what is more the Lord healed him to? So the result was that the school teacher, he was let out of his work too. And dismissals followed in almost every department of the work over there, in the Australasian division. Nevertheless, the work spread and there was a general acceptance of it, not large numbers, but in different parts of Australasia, the message was laid hold of by a group of people. And the Australasian division began to oppose it. You might say, well, what method did they use to oppose it? Well, they used this method. They didn't attack it doctrinally. I don't know whether they examined it doctrinally. This book wasn't published then. At that time, it wasn't out. I, at that time, handed it in to the publishers to run off the press. But they said, well, apparently they determined how would they oppose it. And they said, well, let's have a look at Vision by the Editor. Well, 6 months before that had already been withdrawn, and I threatened to the division and said, well, I don't want to cause any trouble over that. That was withdrawn. So that doesn't matter. They got the vision by the helical. And then they began to write anything I'd ever written, studies and so on, and they asked me for some studies, and I sent down to the president a heap of studies, and he sent them back. Evidently he found no error in the doctrinal presentation. But they found a little manuscript written which was called Development Before and After the Minneapolis 1888. I wrote it while I was a freshman at college, a compilation of statements on Sister White on 1888. And what I wrote it for, we were interested that people would read this material of Wagner and Jones. And in order to stimulate interest in the writings of Wagner and Jones, I'd written this little compilation that they'd read of the message that was presented, to get their interest so that they'd read Wagner and Jones. Well, the result was I'd collected statements from here and there and everywhere, and when I saw it, if I saw a good statement in 1888 from someone else had written anything in 1888, I'd say, well, there's a good statement. I think I'll put that in my compilation, you see. Well, I did a little bit of that, although most of it was from original sources. Well, it happened that the brethren found four mistakes in that compilation written back in 1955, although it was long since out of circulation. I never even had a personal copy of it myself. They found four mistakes, and in vision by the medical, they found one here, a quotation there, where this word by some was left out, which was copied from this one in 1955. That's where it came from. One was a wrong reference, one was two words left out by some, and another one was a statement by A.T. Jones, which I thought in my research was made by Ellen G. White. And the other statement was a more or less a quibble over context. So they had these four statements, see these four errors. They were mostly, you'd almost classify them as typographical errors, which were very insignificant, extremely so. If anybody wants to examine them, you can see them. But large meetings were called all over the Australasian division. You have no idea. Tremendous amount of money must be spent. Calling ministerial institutes, calling workers' meetings, calling great gatherings all over Australia, where they stood up and read these mistakes. They said, now, there's an agitation on at the present time. We want you people to know the basis of these agitations. The basis of it is, of course, an attack against the church, and it's only made up by misused statements of the spirit of prophecy, garbled, put out of their context, words added to, words taken away, and they'd stand up. Now we'll read you an example of how these people misread the spirit of prophecy. Now they'd read them four or five, and they didn't have very many to read, so they took the manuscript Whelan and Short, which they attributed to me, not directly, but they attributed to me, 1888 re-examined, and they picked the mistakes out of Whelan and Short, which they added to my account, to make, because four or five mistakes wasn't enough, and they said, for instance, friends make claims that we have to preach the cross. No serious attempt, just a collection of statements. And so they said, well, this is a sample of the misuse and the garbling of the testimony. This is what this agitation is based upon. We could go on reading, you know, reading, say statement after statement, but this is just a few of the typical errors that are used. And so, by that means, the message was spread in Australia. It caused prejudice in the minds of the vast majority of people. It did. It caused prejudice. And yet, here and there, there were people who would listen and say, well, so what? That's a mistake made. That's a typographical error. And some would say, well, we've seen them and they're even in the public books. Plenty of those have got about. And some people would say, well, why are they going to so much trouble going from place to place, calling meetings? When we come here, we don't hear the doctrine, but we hear these mistakes over and over again. The story was told here and there and everywhere. And so some began inquiring. And so by means of this, the message was, rather than hindered, I think the overall picture was spread. However, it did raise up enmity. I was told by a worker who was present at one of the workers' meetings in Brisbane. He was present at the workers' meeting where they pointed out these errors and gave a big story how the whole spirit of prophecy was misused and so on. He said, you know, he said, the feeling in that workers' meeting was so intense. He said, if you'd walked in there, he says, our pastor so-and-so had them worked up to such a pitch against you. He said, if you'd walked into that meeting, he said, that just about torn you to bits. Well, I thought at last, I thought, well, maybe that's an exaggeration. But the same meeting was held in New Zealand, same sort of thing. And my brother and I went to New Zealand the beginning of 1960. And our first day in New Zealand was New Year's Day. And we had a few, it was camp time on. Camp time in New Zealand. By the way, I was still a good member of the church, officially, and still in good and regular standing. So we went, so we heard that there were some friends of ours at the campground in New Zealand. And they wanted to meet us, they were there at the camp. So my brother and I went on to the campground to meet these friends of ours. We never got a chance to meet our friends there. Because someone must have spotted us. Quickly we were mobbed by about 20 ministers. It was Friday, Sabbath was coming on, Friday afternoon, it wasn't long by Sabbath. I'm sorry to say that the spirit there was anything but the best. It was very much like a football brawl. They wanted to get us off the ground in a hurry, and things were so intense that we were willing to go too. So someone sings out, well, bring the police, we'll put them off the ground. So I said, sure. I said, bring the police, they'll put us off in a very decent manner, they'll take us off. And but one, two of the workers were rolling up their sleeves on the side and said, well, we don't need the police, we'll do it ourselves. Apparently they wanted the pleasure doing themselves. But it was a strange incident happened. There was about 20 men who were 20 workers, which later on one worker who wasn't a minister was watching just from a distance. He told us that everyone in that brawl, because you could hardly call it anything else, he said everyone was a meat eater, which probably explains if a man can't control his passion. But some, it was a strange thing. We didn't want to get away. I wanted to get away from the ugly scene. Certainly didn't want to prolong it. But some of the ministers wanted to take us off the ground this way, and some wanted to take us off that way, and they couldn't agree amongst themselves. So a number of them would say, go this way. I'd say, all right, we'll go this way. And some of them would say, no, go this way. And we turn and try and go this way. And with the man in the middle, who was the leading man there, who was singing out the orders, and so we'd try and go that way, and they'd jump in front of us and tell us to go this way. Then we'd try and go this way, and they'd send us back this way. And believe it or not, and then some begin to sing out, see how impossible they are? We can't do anything with them. So this went on for, I don't know how long it went on, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and the scene was so disgraceful, really it was, that in the end I was quite upset over the whole affair. And I said to them in the end, I said, brethren, I said, you're behaving like a lot of wild beasts. I said, this is shocking. This is shocking. And at that time I heard a shout from behind and another minister came in. He was a Maori. And he was a very thick-set man. Powerful built. Moved in. We could hear his voice above everybody else. Move out of the way. And he pushed 3 or 4 workers this way and 3 or 4 workers that way. And he stood in the midst of the lot of them. Out! He said, out! And he cleared a track in the midst of them. He says, leave these brethren alone. He says, treat them like human beings. Now, come on, he says, you follow me. So everything died away and we walked off the campground. Well, evidently, I don't know why the thing happened that way, but it turned out for the good. One was that a few lay people saw the whole scene. They saw it, they were eyewitnesses of it. And the news spread around the ground. We felt impressed to go to New Zealand, but we never had any plans when we got there. We didn't know where we were going to preach or where we were going to go. We knew that there were people there who wanted to meet us. And the result was that from there, invitations came from one end of New Zealand to the other. We were a full month, night after night, preaching 10 here, 20 there, 15 here, another 20 here. Little groups all over New Zealand. Night after night, sometimes John went one way and I went to another. It was amazing how the way opened up to the preaching of the message. That was in 1960 in New Zealand. And there was quite a large number of people who were rejoicing in the call to the sanctuary at that time. Well, the books began to come off the press by that time, and pamphlets and so on. And by this, there was one man in America who, with his ears open, and was A.L. Nutter. He wanted to know what was going on over there. And he wrote,
He wrote to everybody he could. He wrote to ministers, he wrote to workers, he wrote to laity. He tried to get to both sides of it. Both to what was going on over there. He wanted to know the theology of it. And Warren Hudson was very interested in it. He was interested in following this manuscript, Warning and Steel and Short. He believed that was the message of God. Whelan and Short had requested that the General Conference brethren go back and examine the 1888 message. The submissions were rejected. Whelan and Short had handed the matter over to Providence and said, right, we'll rest it there. And Hudson was waiting for the Lord to work somewhere else. And so he wanted to know what was the theology of the agitation, and he saw it was but a development or the next step from Whelan and Short. He saw it was based on the sanctuary. Hudson was very interested in the concept of the true and the false Christ and how to distinguish between the true and the false Christ himself. And so he published The Open Door in the Church Triumphant. You may have read The Open Door. The result was from that we got a lot of correspondence from doctors, from ministers and from laity, right here from America, some of them requesting that we come over here to America. However, we didn't know anything about the request to come. We thought if it was the Lord's will to come, we'd leave it in the hands of Providence and wait. And so we waited. And we corresponded with a few of the folk in America about some of these things. Getting near the end of 1960, I was seeking the Lord what to do. Was impressed to that I ought to answer the call that some were making, that I'd come to America, and some of the other ones who were interested in the message over there felt the same way. And I thought, well, if convictions are true, they'll keep. So I did keep, and we began corresponding with Hudson, and Hudson thought, well, it'd be a good thing for to come to America, but I don't feel the time is right yet. And so he wrote over and says, no, the time is not ready to come to America. And so I was willing to say, well, right, that's not time to go yet. So we'll leave it. But the Lord had convicted me particularly that the time was to go. We had no plan, so a few of us met together, decided who would accompany me. It was about a dozen believers met together who believed, standing for the message over there. We had prayer and counsel together. And after a time, we decided that it was decided that my brother John would be best to accompany me over here to America. We had no plans when we came here. We kept it quiet from Australia. We didn't want any more prejudice here than we could help it. So we kept it quiet until the time we said, well, let the brethren in Australia and everybody know, even our friends, so know that we're going to America when we're in America. So we kept it quiet. The day came for us to catch the plane. And we got on the plane, and I remember John and I were walking up to the plane. We were even with a touch of humour of the fact, well, here we are, we're going to America. We've kept it pretty quiet, haven't we? And almost congratulating ourselves on the fact that here we were, the next thing that the places know we'd be over in America, and we might have a chance to meet some of the people over here before the prejudice began, because prejudice is a terrible thing to meet. Well, we're just walking up onto the plane, into the big Boeing 707, and to seat us down in our seat, and who should be sitting right next to us? The three leading men of the Australasian Division. So they were going to Fiji, and we didn't know whether they were going to San Francisco. We were listening, and we thought, well, maybe they heard that we're going, and they're going over there too, or something. We didn't know. It seemed to be so strange. Sitting right next to us. So the hostess came down the aisle, and the hostess said, well, asking the passengers, each one, where are you going to? And they leaned across to the brethren and said, well, where are you going to? And John and I listened like this, you know, Fiji. And then the next thing, the hostess came over here to us, where are you gentlemen going to? And you could see the brethren. San Francisco. Well, the result was that when we got to America, a letter got to America from the leaders of the Australasian Division, and so some of you saw the reprint of the letter in the Church Triumph. They wrote a letter from Fiji telling the brethren over here that are on our way and look out, and of course that got amongst the field and was exaggerated and so on and so on. But we got to America, we had no plans, we got to Hudson's place, and Hudson is, those of you know him, he's quite a cautious and cool customer, you know. And he was interested, but I don't think he wanted to be caught out on anything. So we had a few studies there at Hudson's place, and he has, of course, listened carefully and followed the doctrinal position of the message, and gave publicity to it in the Church Triumphant. And we found that we got here to America. Our position was this: before we got to America, our position had been that we were entirely self-supporting. We had never accepted either tithes or offerings, not even offerings for support. But when we got here to America, we paid our own way across. I sold my motor car to get enough money, and sold we had sold our piano even and some of the furniture to get enough money to get across here. Although we had I got an investment in a small property over there, but I didn't sell that. So we got across here to America, and the call started coming in so prolifically to different parts. It was evident that we never had the finances to make the calls, plane fares and so on, and petrol fares. And so the result was, I took the position well for those and talked it over with Hudson. It was quite legitimate to accept expenses. And Hudson put a little notice in the Church Triumphant of those who had invited us to take studies at places. Would be quite an order for them to send into an expense account that he was opening, and mentioned there that we weren't calling for tithes whatsoever. Matter of fact, some people sent in tithes and mentioned that it was tithes, and that was returned to them. The result was that in America, calls came in everywhere, and the result was the way was opened up for the preaching of the call of the sanctuary here in America. Well, you folks know about that. In April, we went to the General Conference. We met with five of the brethren over there. By the way, I've mentioned that the first thing that I did when I got to America, I rang up the leading brethren in Washington. All of them said, well, we'll come straight to Washington if you're interested. We believe this is urgent, otherwise we wouldn't be here. That was the conviction of our heart, desperately urgent. But we'd come straight to Washington to meet the brethren. The brethren weren't interested at that time. They said, well, before we can have a hearing, we want to get in contact with the Australasian Division. We want to hear their side of the story. We want to know what their position is. And so they took the time to find out all about it from the Australasian Division, which made it even harder for them, really, because once they find out the Australasian Division attitude, it's very hard for them to go contrary to what one division has done. But however, after a delay of a few months, or what was it, 2 or 3 months, and we had gone up and down the west coast here, the message had spread far and wide, then the way opened up. We met with a special committee over there in the Australasian, or rather in the General Conference. There were five brethren there. We met with them over about 3 days. We presented a study for them for 4 hours, and mostly then after that we listened to their counsel on the subject. We listened very earnestly. The meetings were very cordial, in a friendly atmosphere. The atmosphere was much better than the Australasian Division. We were pleased that they didn't take the position of the Australasian Division, that we won't even consider it until you promise that you abide by our decision. As such, I don't think that anybody can conscientiously take with a group of small men. But we met with the brethren there. The atmosphere was cordial. We listened to their counsel. We wrote it down. And after we felt that we didn't receive much in the way of help, because I don't think they had one serious doctrinal objection to the message. Some of you have read their answers to it. If there's any doctrinal objection to the message, if there is any serious weighty argument against it, it's yet to come forth. There may be, I don't know. There may be one or two things on the perimeter. I think that we should take the position of Sister White. She mentioned Wagner and James' message in 1888. She said that we need not expect perfection in any man's investigation. Now, if you expect perfection in any man's investigation, of course, you'll be disappointed. And if you're not disappointed, you'll be deceived, because it won't be perfect anyway. I'm not saying that they won't find things on the perimeter and things to quibble about. But there hasn't been, we say in all seriousness, there hasn't been from anybody in any quarter one serious objection yet to the message. There hasn't been one that has been sustained. And so I got back, I didn't know whether I'd continue preaching or not, and the brethren gave me the counsel to go to Arabia like the Apostle Paul for 3 years and sort yourself out and so on, And that may have been good counsel, I don't know. But the only thing I could do was to take it to the Lord. And I didn't know whether I'd continue for not. I waited down at Loma Linda, I think it was for a period of quite a few weeks, seeking what the Lord's will would be on the subject. And the decision that was step I had to make. But it warned me if I continued to preach, that I would be relieved of my membership in the church. Of course, I don't think that should affect one's decision if he has a call to do anything. I don't think a person should consider consequences. And you know the story from that. My decision that I made was to continue in spite of the fact that the recognising that the highest officers of this church had voiced themselves in opposition, requested me to stop preaching. I realised the seriousness of the fact that I decided to go on preaching in spite of that. I realise also the decision that I have to stand before the judgment bar of Christ and answer for that decision which I've made. I don't know from here on what the future holds. I came across a statement someone gave to me. From time to time I have to make the decision, even from week to week and from day to day. Shall I continue? Shall I stop? I don't know next week whether I'll stop or not. The only safety I know is to ask the Lord at each step, is this the way that he would have me go? But I was given this at a time of crisis in my own personal experience, not very long ago, and someone gave me this, I don't know who wrote it, but I read it, and it was a source of encouragement. It's called Keep At Your Work. The Lord has given to every man his work. It is his business to do it, and the devil's business to hinder him if he can. So sure that God has given you a work to do, Satan will try to hinder you. He may present other things more promising. He may allure you by worldly prospects. He may assault you with slander, torment you with false accusations, set you at work defending your character, employ pious persons to lie about you, editors to assail you, and excellent men to slander you. You may have Pilate and Herod, Ananias and Caiaphas all combined against you, and Judas standing by ready to sell you for 30 pieces of silver. And you may wonder why all those things come upon you. Can you not see that the whole thing is brought about through the craft of the devil, to draw you off from your work and hinder your obedience to God? Keep about your work. Do not flinch because the lion roars. Do not stop to stone the devil's dogs. Do not fool away your time, chasing the devil's rabbits. Do your work. Let liars lie, let sectarians quarrel, let the devil do his work. But see to it that nothing hinders you from fulfilling the work that God has given you. He has not sent you to make money. He has not commanded you to get rich. He has never bidden you to defend your character. He has not set you at work to contradict falsehoods which Satan and his servants may start to peddle. If you do these things, you will do nothing else. You will be at work for yourself and not for the Lord. Keep about your work. Let your aim be as steady as a star. Let the world brawl and bubble. You may be assaulted, wronged, insulted, slandered, wounded, rejected. You may be abused by foes, forsaken by friends, and despised and rejected of men. But see to it with steadfast determination, with unfaltering zeal, that you pursue the great purpose of your life and object of your being until at last you can say, I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do.